Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today my guest is Dr. Jason Hoden. Jason is a senior research scientist at the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Laboratory. He's a marine biologist, entomologist, and educator. I would also say he seems to be a bit of a philosopher, too, because check out his website, because he has a daily Dow for your consideration. Today we'll be talking with Jason Hoden about his research efforts, which are focused on expanding the scientific knowledge of the life history of sunflower stars and learning how to raise them from eggs to juveniles in order to, hopefully, help restore healthy populations in the wild. And Dr. Hoden will be giving the first of this winter's Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Oceans lecture series. It'll be on Sunday, October the 8th, and I'll give you a little more information at the end of the show. But first, before we talk to Jason, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, I'll give you a little hint if you haven't figured it out already. These creatures were first brought to North America by Shakespeare enthusiasts. It was in the 19th century. And they actually do have a semantic relationship to the subject of today's program. So I'm really happy to have Dr. Jason Hoden with us today. And we're talking sea star wasting and maybe some things that can provide hope for restoring some of the sea stars. Now, to remind listeners, Nature Now has been following the story of sea star wasting since that very first year in 2013 and 14 when we noticed the breakout on our coast. And the last program we had on sea star wasting was just about a year ago. It was September 22, and it featured Dr. Jay Gatos of the Sea Doc Society. And for background, I encourage you all to go find that on a podcast. But I'm reflecting that, Jason, I saw a news article just recently, and I think it was in one of the Skagit papers, that there seems to be an uptick in the disease based on some recent surveys, and that the devastation that was wrought on the sunflower stars seems to be persistent. So can you just give us a quick status of what's it like out there in the Salish Sea for sea stars and the wasting disease?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I should start by saying that it's a rather difficult question to answer. Great that we have a lot of people out looking around and making observations, but getting actually really good quality data on wasting proportions over time for different species is pretty difficult. Getting access to all the different environments that sea stars live in is very seasonal, and you know, we get more data for the summer, for example, than for the winter.
Sure, and it's got more eyes out there, yeah.
Got more eyes out there, but I don't. A lot of the people in the region might notice that we don't really get low tides during the day during the winter. So if we're monitoring a lot of our stuff intertidally, which
summer's
a lot of monitoring
the times
is,
to do it, yeah.
And so you know, I'm just giving all of that background in terms of saying that, like, to really get a sense for a true status report on, like, you know, if you have in your mind some of those CDC graphs on COVID over time and spikes and things like that, we can't really be that confident in those kinds of data for sea star wasting. But having said that, I think the general impression out there is that there was a sort of a prolonged outbreak for the first few years following 2013 to 14, as you said, where we saw a lot of sick and dying stars. And then it seemed to kind of level out for a few years. And then there is a general impression that there might be a little bit of an uptick happening again. I haven't seen evidence that it's, you know, anywhere near as bad as it was in 2013 and 2014. But it is out there. And like the previous outbreak, it's affecting multiple species. We do see wasting in sunflower stars, although I don't think at this point we can really say that they're especially hard hit by the latest round of wasting versus other species. But we definitely are seeing wasting out there in the wild, and it's kind of episodic, and you get reports from different locations and so on. So yes, it is definitely still out there, with one more little caveat for you, that because we don't know what the disease is, I can't even tell you that it's exactly the same as it was in 2013, 2014.
Yeah, I was sort of wondering, there's been a lot of work done on what is the disease. And I still kind of have that question in my mind of wasting disease is your kind of generic, you described the results, but is it a disease where we can see with enough scientific research we could find a causative agent, or is it just what happens when sea stars, when they're stressed by a variety of things? Do you have an idea of what it is?
Yeah, I mean, that really great question. And we don't know the actual cause of sea star wasting, which is, you know, unfortunate. And it also makes things difficult for all the kind of research that myself and others are doing. And you're correct that there is an ongoing effort to try to make some progress in identifying the cause. Some recent research seems to indicate, it's not published yet, not entirely sure, but it seems to indicate that it is likely that there is sort of a traditional disease at work here, meaning that there is something like a virus or a bacteria or a fungus or something like that that is a direct cause. What that actually is, we still don't know, and I can't even narrow it down to those different, very, very different groups of organisms that I just mentioned.
The part of the problem that you're working on is more about understanding, if I've got it right, it's more about understanding the specific life history of a specific species and then trying to figure out how to help it reproduce more effectively. Hope in the ability to reproduce, and you're working on the notion of rearing in a lab and outplanting. And we're a little bit familiar with that here because we hear a lot about the pinto abalone rearing and outplanting. So I'm assuming that's the same kind of idea.
Yeah, it's a similar kind of idea. And in fact, they sort of walk the path before us, as it were. And so, you know, we are kind of following in those footsteps. Yes, we are focused on one given species of sea star wasting that was impacted by sea star wasting. Again, you know, just to, you know, really quickly go over this was actually something very unusual about the sea star wasting outbreak that occurred in 2013 to 2014, and that we apparently are still seeing to this day, which, as I mentioned before, it affects more than one species. That is not something that had ever been observed before, even though smaller outbreaks in more limited geographic areas of wasting have been observed all over the world for quite some time. But nothing quite this serious in terms of the scope of the species that it affected or the geographic area over which, you know, we saw these effects at that time and through the present. So of all of the species that were impacted, the one that unfortunately was impacted the worst is the species that we are working on now. It's the sunflower star. It's a top predator, and its historic range was quite extensive all the way from Alaska to Mexico. Brilliantly colored, huge number of arms, much more active than your typical sea star that you might think of, and also well-known to biologists being a vicious predator that eats a wide variety of seashore creatures on the seafloor. And, you know, probably heard, you and your listeners have probably heard about a number of other types of top predatory species in the modern era whose disappearances have been, the cascading effects of them have been felt very, very broadly. Things like wolves, otters, and so forth. And so sharks, the list is quite long. And so just like with those taxa, with the sunflower star, when they disappeared, we started to see some pretty major ecological consequences, apparently quite quickly, and especially in California, which is one of the places where they were hit the hardest. So they are impressive species that anybody who's seen one probably will never forget it. But in addition to that, they're extremely important ecologically. You know, all species are important, but top predators in particular seem to have these very, very important functions in regulating entire ecosystems.
Which goes to the question of why should we care about these critters? Because they are so important in the ecosystem. Now, for any of you who may just be tuning in, this is Nan Evans with KPTZ's Nature Now program. And I'm talking with Dr. Jason Hoden about efforts to understand sea star reproduction and to grow baby sea stars in a lab setting for hopeful repopulation in the wild. With the sun stars, or sunflower stars, I know enough about echinoderm, which is the phylum that sea stars are in, know enough about the reproduction to know that it's widely variable across groups and across species. How did you approach the notion of figuring out the life history steps in the sunflower and how you would even go about trying to improve their reproduction by supporting those first stages? How'd you go about that?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, first of all, that was nice to hear you mention the sort of diversity of reproductive strategies across different kinds of echinoderms, the spiny skinned animals, that includes things like sea stars and sea urchins and sea cucumbers. Many of them reproduce in a similar fashion where they release tons and tons and tons of babies into the water that have to basically fend for themselves. And a very small percentage of those will eventually settle down, survive through their juvenile stages, and become a reproductive adult themselves. There are also some sea stars that your listeners might be familiar with. There's a famous sort of near shore local one that a lot of people see. It's the six arm star.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's got this variety, a variable number of arms. If you do happen to go down to a low tide in the middle of the night in the winter here, and you turn over some rocks and you find those six arm sea stars in the places you're used to, you'll see something very interesting, which is that they're brooding their babies underneath their mouth. And so they're kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. They're actually more like us in that they're putting a lot of parental care into a smaller number of individuals, whereas sunflower stars are more like what we think of as more typical among a lot of marine invertebrates and echinoderms, as you mentioned, that they tend to produce just tons and tons of offspring, this massive overproduction early on, and then eventually, you know, it sort of works out that enough of them survive into adulthood. But yes, yeah, so that's the background on this. And actually, it's because of that massive production of offspring. That's one of the reasons why echinoderms have been studied for a long time for their embryology and early development, because you can reliably get so many offspring for studies. And so something like a sea urchin is a commonly used research organism, partially for that reason. Sea stars, when they grow up, we can use a lot of the same techniques that we use for sea urchins with some slight modifications. And so, you know, growing up the larvae, these little planktonic microscopic forms that feed on phytoplankton for, you know, maybe months at a time, those stages, actually, we weren't that worried that we would be able to do it. There was a publication on it, and there was enough work on a number of different species that we felt that that was probably going to be possible. What the challenge that we thought we were going to face was getting them to transition into little baby juveniles on the seafloor, which happens at a size that you can barely see. They're about the size of a poppy seed at that point. And then growing them up from that poppy seed-sized juvenile to one of the largest sea stars known in the world. That, we thought, might be a challenge because it hadn't been done before, and we didn't know anything about what those stages, how they grew up. And one of the reasons why we don't know that for this species, as well as most sea stars, as it turns out, is probably because aside from their, you know, extreme ecological importance that we talked about, direct relevance to humans, maybe not so much. Not so much like species like sea urchins, which we actually eat.
Right.
And so for those reasons, you know, we were going into this a little bit blind in these early stages, and we knew it could be problematic because they are top predators. So, you know, caring for something that eats other things then raises other sorts of challenges too, right? And so those were sort of the things that we expected to encounter difficulties, and we did encounter those difficulties we expected, and you know, did manage to make our way through, but it was a fair bit of work and trial and error early on.
So just a quick question. What gave you the confidence that you could actually successfully do this?
Well, I guess I'm a kind of an optimist, I guess.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, I had contacts with some colleagues that were, you know, sort of cheering me on from the sidelines, but, you know, were expressing the same sorts of issues that I had. There was a famous sea star biologist, and unfortunately died a few years back, but I was able to be in touch with him when I was first getting this project started. And one of the final things that he said to me in an email was, "Do you think you're going to be able to solve the juvenile rearing problem for sea stars?" I mean, this is something that biologists such as himself and other ones have been thinking about for a long time.
Yeah, and it's a real basic question. Yeah,
it's a basic question. I mean, and he, among most of the other biologists out there, were interested in it because of its important basic research function. But the reason why it probably hadn't received a bunch of funding and hadn't been done before is because maybe we hadn't seen what the consequences could be as directly, mm-hmm. you know, as we saw, you know, starting about a decade ago.
You know, another thing I think about, and I'm sure you must too, is that when humans get involved in some form of, you know, quote unquote, helping Mother Nature, we get oftentimes a lot of unexpected consequences. Have you encountered any of those so far? Are you worried about things like maintaining enough genetic diversity or other sorts of things that, you know, as I said, we're often well-intended as humans, but often strange, unexpected things occur?
Well, yeah, that's for sure. There was just a big recent report from the United Nations about invasive species and the economic costs that they've started to calculate, mm-hmm. which is probably a great underestimate. The kinds of things that not well thought out, say, manipulations of nature can have. So yes, we want to be very conscious about these things. There are a few differences that are important to point out. I mean, you did mention some important questions regarding genetic diversity and so on, and there's other ones as well. We are talking about restoring a species to its habitat where it was found previously. Mm-hmm. So we're not trying to move sunflower stars to, you know, the coast of South America or something mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. which I would not recommend. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. But your questions about, you know, genetic diversity, making sure that we don't want to go to all this effort and introduce sunflower star genetic lines from the Pacific Northwest, for example, into California, if they're just going to die as soon as they get down there because they're not suited for that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So we are concerned about those sorts of things. There's probably even bigger concerns that regulators have and that we share about large-scale reintroductions, which is related to the disease. Because we don't know what the disease is and because we can't test for it, you know, we really want to make sure, if I was going to say that I would be something that I would be the most worried about in moving stars around to areas where they weren't previously found, like ones from the Northwest down to California, say, it would be in moving a disease variant, which could be a Northwest disease variant. We have mm-hmm. no idea, since we don't know how to test for it, down to California that they're naive to. And then, you know, even start a new wave of wasting down there with the new variant. I mean, you know, we'd like to try to avoid that. I mean, honestly, those kind of things could be happening all the time. I mean, you know, sure. We're trying to be exceedingly careful in the stuff we're doing. Ships are filling up with ballast water in the Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest and dumping it down in California.
Spewing it everywhere.
Being honest about this fact, like, you know, the care that needs to be taken in all of these areas is not being taken to the extent that it probably should be, but we are trying to do our best to sort of game out these scenarios in advance so that we, you know, don't create any problems, you know, inadvertently.
So we're kind of nearing the end of our time, but I really want to know, have you been able to outplant some stars? How's it going? Are you hopeful?
Yeah, so these stars here that you're alluding to, I don't think I've mentioned, we have been now raising generations of sunflower stars in our lab for 4 years now. And
wow.
So we, our oldest stars born in captivity are going to be coming up on their fourth birthday in the next about several months here. They've already reached reproductive status. So we found this out, but then about 3 years they're reproductive. So in fact, in this fourth round that we did this year, some of the offspring that we're raising now are actually offspring of entirely wild-born stars, which is very cool and is, of course, an important milestone for any captive breeding program. But also when we think about, you know, this disease that's still out there and other potential problems that these stars face in the wild that aren't at all related to the disease, potentially related to climate change and other things, you know, we think about the idea that is when we're doing this captive breeding program, if we can scale it up, we want to do it to an extent where we could potentially select for types that are more resistant to the disease or that do better in a warmer climate, for example. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of things that we're actively thinking about. And we're doing some experiments around those. As far as the question that you asked, another thing is when you raise stars in captivity, like we've done, under very, very careful, you know, trying to be as controlled as we can. I mean, we have flowing seawater in our facility at Friday Harbor Labs, University of Washington on San Juan Island, where we do the work. We have flowing seawater, and we filter it down, but it still is, you know, live seawater. But we do try to protect the stars from stuff that comes in through our seawater system, you know, that can be filtered out. And so those stars, when they've been in this situation where they've been in captivity, been sort of protected from a lot of the vagaries in the environment, been fed as much as they want to eat, basically, mm-hmm. Are they actually going to be fit in a wild context? And so we were able to get the first sort of evidence for this summer, where a dive team that was working in our group went out, and we designed cages, built them, put our stars into these cages, that we designed this subtidal system where we could monitor and clean and feed them and keep them out there for a little bit over 2 months. And so we just did that at three different sites around San Juan Island with these stars in cages. And we brought back our stars last week. And as of right now, they all look great. We didn't lose any stars. They clearly grew while they were out there, and they look quite healthy. So this was a really important thing for us to find. First of all, as you noted, there is wasting still out in the wild, and you know, we were worried that our stars might just immediately succumb, and they didn't, which was a good thing. Also, the idea that they are, you know, robust enough to survive, you know, summertime conditions out there, and then in addition to that, we've come up with this method for being able to monitor stars out in the wild. So just even developing the techniques that we developed and that the dive team perfected, and you know, that we can now, you know, start to replicate in different locations and looking at a variety of research questions out in the field now really gives us a lot of advantages and gets us some steps towards not only the point at which we can do actual outplanting someday where we just release the stars and be confident about that, but indeed get the approvals that you would need to do that, because the regulatory agencies in California, for example, they're going to want to see results of experiments Sure. Like the one that we did this summer, showing that we know what we're doing and mm-hmm. we're checking off boxes.
Well, you've made me hopeful, and I want to encourage all listeners to catch Jason Hoden's upcoming Port Townsend Marine Science Center lecture, as I'm sure he'll go much deeper than we've been able to go here. That will be Sunday, October the 8th, 3 o'clock in the Fort Worden Chapel, Bringing Up Baby Stars. So that it should be fun. And Jason, I'm so glad you were able to spend some time with us. Thank you
so much. Well, it's my pleasure. And I'll just say about that upcoming lecture, one difference from this one is that you'll be able to see pictures of our
That's stuff. True. The advantage of being in person rather than on the radio. Thanks again so very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Let's now listen to that mystery sound again. That was the sound of a flock of European starlings, not baby stars. Bad joke. Anyway, starlings are relatives of the minor birds, and they have a seriously impressive vocal abilities and a great gift for mimicry. They warble, whistle, chatter, squeak, trill, rattle, and imitate all kinds of other birds. And the point about Shakespeare... Well, today's massive coast-to-coast population of starlings all descended from about 100 birds released in New York City's Central Park in the 1890s. It was a result of some Shakespearean enthusiasts who imported birds to North America in an effort to have every bird mentioned in any of Shakespeare's plays alive in North America. It's another example of human meddling, I think. So, I want to remind you all to go to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center lecture on Sunday, October the 8th, 3 o'clock in the Fort Warden Chapel. And then in closure, I want to tell you how excited the Nature Now team is to announce that you can now listen to podcasts directly on your podcast app on your smartphone. Simply open your app, type in Nature Now, and you'll be transported to many podcasts of this and past shows. And if you like these podcasts, we do hope you'll share the news with family and friends, maybe even write a review on the podcast website. Well, we thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed our program. I want to also thank today's sound engineer, Nora Petridge. And the ending music is When You Wish Upon a Star, recorded by Billy Joel. And of course, this tune was written for Walt Disney's 1940 production of Pinocchio.
One of them is this. They have the power to make a dream come true. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do, fate is kind. She brings to those who love the sweet fulfillment of their secret longing. Like a boat out of the blue, fate steps in.